This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture with me, Dasharan Johan. Over the past couple of weeks, tens of thousands of Indonesians led by students have taken to the streets and protested against a new law that could potentially affect workers' rights as well as the environment. In some parts of the country, these protests have turned violent and many have been arrested. So, on today's episode of Live and Learn, I will be examining these important protests, the controversial omnibus law that started it all, and also take a broader look at the political landscape of Indonesia to find out why the Indonesian youth and students have been growing increasingly dissatisfied with the political elite over the past couple of years. But as always, I can't do this alone. So joining me on Skype is Eve Warburton, postdoctoral fellow at the National University of Singapore's Asia Research Institute, and whose field of expertise include democracy and politics in Indonesia. She's also the co-editor of the book Democracy in Indonesia, From Stagnation to Regression. Hello, Eve. Welcome and good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So if perhaps you can start by giving us an overview, why are there protests in Indonesia? I touched on it briefly in my introduction, but maybe you can help me make sense of it a little bit more.
Sure. So I think you can sort of put protesters' grievances into kind of three categories. They're on the streets protesting the passing of this omnibus law, and they're protesting its substance. They're protesting the process by which the law was passed. And to a degree, they're also protesting the government's response to their opposition. So in terms of substance, what this law does is it's huge and it amends over around 70 existing laws. And the protesters are very concerned with what this law does to workers' rights. They're very concerned about what it does to the environment. But what they're really also protesting is the process by which this law kind of came into being. So despite how complicated it is and how huge it is, it was really deliberated only for less than a year, which is a really short time period in the context of Indonesian sort of legal processes. And it was opportunistically sort of rushed through the DPR, or the National Parliament, in the final stages, basically under the cover of the pandemic. There was very little public consultation, and the only segment of society that was really consulted directly and in detail, and indeed had immense influence over this law, was the business community by the Indonesian Chamber of Commerce and the Indonesian Employers Association. So they had a really big hand in designing this law, but labor unions didn't, NGOs didn't, economists and scholars didn't. There was also a real lack of transparency, especially in the final stages of deliberating the law. So we have a situation really quite remarkable where the bill that was passed by the parliament and the bill that was sent to the president for signing are different. So Indonesian law allows for some very, very small changes to be made to law to bills that have been passed by the parliament before they get signed in by the president, you know, typos, formatting, things like this. But behind closed doors and with no monitoring, it seems now as though the DPR inserted extra phrases, the page length changed by hundreds. So there's all this sort of weird stuff going on with this law, and there was very little transparency surrounding it. And finally, the third grievance, this category of grievances of these protesters is the government's response to opposition. So there's a lot of frustration with how the government has responded to the grievances of civil society activists and the students and labor unions when it comes to this law. There's been no dialogue with the aggrieved segments of society. Instead, what the government has done is to basically to mobilize the business community, to mobilize religious organizations, governors, all the different parts of government to come together and to basically create a positive narrative about this law, you know, to just sort of drown out the kind of the grievances of civil society activists, unions and students. They've even asked the police to kind of join in kind of spread a kind of positive story about what this omnibus law does. And of course, the other response from the government has been repression. So even in advance of these protests, we have clear evidence of the police going around and sort of harassing, intimidating and even arresting people they believed were involved in organizing the protests. This is prior to the actual protests taking place. And then, of course, on the streets as well, as you said in your introduction, there were some many violent interactions with police at the demonstrations around the country. They're taking a very hardline approach, arrests, intimidation, harassment. And really, these are all tactics that have been applied to try and undermine the movement and to prevent a real sort of show of force on the streets. And I think it actually worked in some ways. I mean, these were big protests, but they would have been a lot bigger had there not been that sort of kind of systematic targeting of protest organizers in the lead up to the actual protests.
What is the Joko Widodo-led government's rationale for tabling and passing this law?
So it's basically meant to be this sort of legislative, you know, revolution for the economy. It's meant to be this big bang law that Joko Widodo, or Jokowi, as we know, President Jokowi, hopes will lead to this, you know, really significant increase in private sector investment. And if a big boost in investment, he hopes, and an expansion of private business will in turn lead to an expansion of new jobs. So it's kind of, it's called the Omnibus Law, but it's also called the law, the, you know, the job creation law. And so the theory is, you know, behind it is that revising this huge number of laws around labor, like, you know, introducing more labor more flexibility into the labor market, reducing taxation, making environmental permitting easier for businesses, doing all these sorts of things is going to attract more investment into Indonesia. And the assumption is that, you know, what's holding back investors. So there's two assumptions, actually. The first assumption is that what's wrong with Indonesia's economy is a lack of investment, that that's what's causing kind of, you know, a lower level of GDP growth than Jokowi, you know, would like. He would like to see it higher than sort of between 5 and 7%.
Right.
And so the problem is investment. And then the second assumption is that what's holding investors back are these kind of rigid labor laws, you know, higher wages, very high severance pay in Indonesia. It is actually one of the highest sort of levels of severance pay in the world up until this law. That environmental protections are holding back investors. And that instead, you know, and this is sort of an obsession that, that Jokowi has, instead Vietnam is taking all this kind of manufacturing investment in particular away from Indonesia. And if Indonesia wants to compete with the money that's sort of flowing into Vietnam these days, it needs to introduce much more flexibility into the labor market. And so that's sort of, it's sort of a classic kind of trickle down, you know, economics sort of approach in a way, because what he's done is delivered to the business community almost their wish list, you know, of things that, that can kind of help them increase their profits, can help them bring down costs, bring down operational costs, can help them sort of deal with complicated bureaucratic licensing processes in Indonesia and make life easier for the business community. And if you do that, they will expand their business investments and they will employ more people, and that will ultimately help growth. So that's the kind of logic behind the law. And it's important to sort of emphasize the kind of president that Jokowi is. You know, he is someone who is has a very kind of narrow set of economic goals for Indonesia. He wants his legacy to be a developmentalist sort of legacy. And he judges, you know, he sort of rates his own success by how many roads he can build, what the GDP growth level is, you know, on his watch. And how much investment he can bring. These are the big targets for Jokowi. He's very much a developmentalist sort of president. You know, he hates bureaucratic red tape. He hates any kind of sort of institutional hindrances to him achieving these goals and achieving them very quickly. And so this law, the way it kind of slashes through sort of, you know, 70 existing laws all in one go, I think is really a reflection of the kind of president Jokowi is. He's one who, he doesn't like process. He doesn't mind throwing democratic process to the side if necessary, as long as he can get something done. He just wants to get something done, and he wants to get it done in this kind of narrow kind of economic sort of realm where, you know, the focus is purely on investment.
We talk about President Jokowi's rationale behind passing this law, but how will it impact the working class citizen? What about this law is driving people to the streets to show that they are in complete disagreement with this law?
Right. So there are several key sort of protections for work that workers have enjoyed in Indonesia for a long time that have been removed by this law. So one important one is that under the previous labor law, if you were employed on a temporary basis, on a temporary contract, if you were employed on that basis for over 3 years, you would automatically become a permanent employee and you would have access to the protections that permanent employment gives you, you know, the sort of securities, leave, sick pay, all that sort of stuff. That has been removed. So businesses can now employ people on a temporary basis indefinitely. So that's a really important one. It's now up to businesses to decide whether they want to give their staff a two-day weekend or a one-day weekend. It used to be that everyone had to have a two-day weekend. So people could be, you know, working for 6 days a week. The severance pay has been, Indonesia had very, very generous severance pay. I think it was 36 months pay when you fire someone. And that's extremely generous. And I think there probably is, you know, grounds for reducing the severance pay, but they've done it quite dramatically. And I think that's really upset a lot of unions as well. Oh, and also, I mean, these sorts of protections need to be negotiated with unions. You can't just, so I think that what's caused so much frustration and anger and opposition is that these protections have been removed unilaterally almost,
right,
and without open and transparent discussion and without bargaining, you know, without bargaining with the unions. Prior to this law, the minimum wage was decided at a very local level in Indonesia. So it was actually at the district level that the minimum wage was determined. And that's because the cost of living across Indonesia's cities varies enormously. So it made a lot of sense, but it is extremely complicated to sort of, you know, for that process to be decided at such a micro level. Now it's decided at the provincial level. But that's caused a lot of concern because what that means is that inevitably there are going to be some workers on the minimum wage that will have those wages adjusted, potentially downwards. So that's another major concern. What this law does is it potentially lowers wages. It absolutely increases job insecurity, and it makes it easier for companies to lay off their workers. So even though the long-term goal here is to increase investment and increase job opportunities, there's a very, very high chance, especially given the economic recession that, you know, the entire world is facing right now, what you'll get instead is layoffs and higher levels of unemployment. And this is what economists are debating, that it could actually have the reverse impact. And this is the kind of issues that weren't debated and that weren't given enough, I think, time for experts to weigh in and to kind of provide, you know, modelling in terms of what could this actually do in the short term. You know, that in other countries, you know, where I'm from, or in Australia, for example, governments are literally paying the private sector to keep workers on. Right. And instead, what Indonesia is doing is introducing a law that makes it easier for the private sector to fire workers, which perhaps long term there is an argument for greater labor inflexibility in Indonesia, but certainly in the short term, that's quite risky. It's very risky, in fact.
So it's one of those laws that benefit big companies, big corporations, at the expense of the common person. But on the other side, you do have Economic Minister Erlangga Hartarto, who's, you know, previously sought to calm protesters and said that many of their fears were based on false information. And I quote, he said, "I can assure you wages will not be cut." Is he trying to hide the truth here? Is this pretty much just one of those political spiels that you come to expect from elite politicians?
Yeah, I don't think he can make that promise. And I would say two things about those comments. First of all, it's a law that is being sort of marketed to investors as a law that gives them more flexibility with their labor force, that they'll be able to take home more money as well. I mean, that's exactly how it's being promoted, that their operational costs are going to come down in Indonesia, and so you should come and invest. And the way it's doing that is it absolutely provides the opportunity for lower wage manufacturing jobs. That's the whole goal. So for Erlangga to suggest that wages won't be cut, I mean, he just certainly can't make that promise. And as I described before, you know, with the readjustment of the process for determining minimum wages, I don't think that there's any guarantee that those adjustments will be upwards. You know, some of them are necessarily going to have to go down, I presume. And that's sort of the goal of the omnibus law. So I don't think that's right. So the second, I think, point that I would make about Erlangga's comments, this idea that protesters' fears and their grievances are based on false information. This is a really important discursive tool that's being used by the Jokowi government to delegitimize the grievances of those who oppose the law. It's, you know, it's this idea that they don't understand it, they haven't read it, they've only read kind of misinformation that's being fed to them on social media. You know, Aranga and others have also suggested that protesters or demonstrators are being organised or perhaps even paid by some unnamed political enemy of the state. And Edward Aspinall wrote a really good article about this recently on New Mandela. And what he said is, like, this is a classic actual New Order tool, like the tool used by the authoritarian regime prior to the democratic transition in 98. And it was used routinely to suggest that protesters don't actually hold or act upon real grievances. Instead, they're kind of manipulated by outside forces. And, you know, today what, you know, the kind of government's line is that they've been manipulated or misled by fake news and fake information online. And it's not true. I mean, if putting aside the fact that any ambiguity surrounding this law is entirely the fault of the politicians themselves, you know, the lack of transparency surrounding the design of the law, you know, that's a serious mm-hmm. problem. But, you know, you can see from the op-eds in the press, from the interviews that are being done on chat shows in Indonesia, that civil society groups like Indonesian Legal Aid Institute, Amnesty International, Indonesia Corruption Watch, you know, these environmental groups like WALHI, these guys know what the law is doing. They've actually read in detail, in more detail than the politicians themselves seem to have read the law. and economists and experts who are weighing in, they understand the law and they're protesting it or criticising it because they believe it's not in the best interest of society, or they're protesting it because they think the process of the law itself was illegal and lacked any kind of meaningful consultation. So this idea that it was, you know, the people who are opposed to the law don't understand it, I think is very misleading, and it's a tool. It's a discursive and a powerful political tool used by the state to discredit opposition and dissent.
Okay, on that note, we do need to take a quick break, but after the break, Eve and I will continue our discussion on the protests that are currently going on in Indonesia. Stay tuned. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm Dasharan Johan, and I'm joined by Eve Warburton, postdoctoral fellow at the National University of Singapore's Asia Research Institute, and whose field of expertise include democracy and politics in Indonesia. So, Eve, before the break, we talked about how these laws will affect the common man, the working class citizen. But how can the omnibus law also affect the environment? Because a lot of what these protests are about is also that the law is going to cause some detrimental damage in the long run to the environment. Can you help me make sense of that a little bit?
Sure. So one of the main, it'll affect the environment in a number of ways. First, and perhaps most alarmingly, the bill removes any kind of public or third party involvement in environmental impact assessments. They're called UMDAL in Indonesia. So effectively leaves public deliberation, external kind of experts and civil society out of those assessments. And the process is now, my understanding, entirely in the hands of the central government. Prior to this law, you know, my understanding is that pretty much all businesses and all extractive and plantation projects would have to have an UMDAL. And now the government will decide whether or not a business or an investment project falls into this high risk category. And I'm not sure what the criteria are for high risk or low risk. But if you're low risk, you don't need an UMDAL at all. Mm. And if you're high risk, it's up to the central government to issue that environmental impact assessment. So, and it also removes reduces the sanctions for companies who violate their UMDAL. And overall, what it's trying to do is free up more land for companies who want to engage in sort of commercial plantations, mining. It makes the licensing process easier, and it eases restrictions based on environmental concerns. Because that's sort of the overall impact,
right?
Of a whole range of the changes. That this law introduces. Now, you know, I worked a little bit in the mining sector as part of my doctoral thesis, and it was very clear when you got into the regions and you talk to environmental NGOs and you talk to academics and experts out in these resource-rich regions, the UMDAL process was already notoriously corrupt.
Right.
And it was a way sort of for, you know, third-party experts who aren't really experts to make a lot of money, you know, it was quite corrupt. So, you know, but they still force some level of transparency. You know, NGOs could still get involved and help demonstrate risks, the risks of extractive and plantation projects. And what was the system needed desperately was a cleanup. But what the government has done instead is remove this process or change it such that it actually is even less transparent than it was before. And so for and it's not just environmental activists that are very concerned about this. You know, there was a letter was written a couple of weeks ago by, I think it was around 35 financial institutions and investment banks,
right,
internationally. And they actually raised serious concerns about the environmental implications of these legal revisions and reminded the government that, in fact, international investors are increasingly wanting to make sustainable investments, that they are increasingly concerned with climate the disastrous effects of climate change. And in a country like Indonesia, which depends, whose export-based economy depends very much on coal and palm oil, two industries that have had a devastating impact on Indonesia's environment. And what this law does is to, in fact, provide them with less environmental checks and more opportunities to engage in deforestation and land accumulation.
There are those who argue that this protest will not realistically accomplish anything. The omnibus law will carry on as planned. What are your thoughts on this?
I mean, the first point I would make is that the demonstrators in this opposition movement against the laws, street protests were really the only option left to accomplish something. So that people have taken their politics onto the streets because other avenues and institutions of representation have basically failed. This is why people took to the streets last year too. You know, towards the end of last year, mm-hmm. there were massive student-led protests against revisions to the KPK law or the law on the Corruption Eradication Commission, revisions that were clearly designed to weaken the powers of the KPK. And they took to the streets then again. And this was right after an election. This was right after Indonesia's legislative and presidential election. And after they voted in their representatives, they found their representatives rushing through extremely controversial, unpopular laws without any real public consultation and against the wishes of many Indonesians. And people see that, so, you know, voting for particular political parties doesn't seem to have helped them, you know, have their preferences represented in parliament or in the lawmaking process. Indonesia's media, while still very, very, you know, while still free and comparatively free and open and autonomous, in fact, has become increasingly partisan over the years, and major media sort of moguls all now kind of, you could describe them as sort of on side with the president, helping to shift the tone of some of their major broadcasts to a sort of a favourable tone, supporting the government and the parliament in favour of these laws. The courts as well, where most Indonesians see the courts where these sorts of laws can be challenged as being very partisan, corrupt, and increasingly so. So when all these sort of other avenues for representation are kind of closed or are narrowing, street protests are sort of the only way that people feel like they can express their opposition. So I'm not sure that these protests will reverse the laws or reverse these revisions, but it's really important way to register opposition, to reveal, and I think to even reveal the increasingly unrepresentative and increasingly repressive tendencies of this administration. I think what the protests show and help to display to the public and to the government is that there's now kind of a larger and louder segment of society calling out and bringing attention to the government's sort of illiberal tendencies. And I'm seeing more and more, and I think since these protests, what they've done is they've changed, I think, the dialogue within certain parts of the Indonesian media. We're seeing people on chat shows now talking about, you know, how justified the omnibus law is, whether the process itself was unrepresentative, but is it illegal? And people are talking more and more about kind of democratic decline and backsliding during the Jokowi administration. So I think what these protests do is to kind of help register opposition and draw attention to a set of grievances that even if they can't change the law itself, they're helping to publicize some of the kind of core deficits in Indonesia's democratic process. I think if we look at the recent past over the last couple of years and the approach of this administration to opposition and dissent, I don't hold a lot of hope for the omnibus law itself. So forces within this administration see a heavy-handed and repressive response as the most effective response to dissent. And I don't think Jokowi was that kind of leader initially, but he's become convinced that to sort of get things done, to achieve his narrow set of developmental goals, things like deliberation, debate, public protest, all this stuff, it just gets in the way. He's very allergic to these sorts of processes. Yeah, so, and, you know, but of course in a democracy, some of these processes are essential. I mean, checks and balances are
definitely
processes. So what we have now is a president who views these sorts of checks and balances on legislative processes, you know, monitoring watchdogs like the KPK. He sort of sees them as investment hindrances, and he's happy to kind of put them to the side or to exclude or to kind of, you know, erode these sorts of institutions and liberal norms for the sake of his growth targets. And I think, you know, he even gave a speech when he was re-elected in 2019 and said, my second term, you know, I'm not going to be burdened by this whole kind of re-election issue. I don't have to be as concerned with public opinion anymore, so I can get the hard stuff done, the really unpopular pieces of legislation passed. And that's precisely what he's doing. So I don't, he knew these laws would be unpopular. That's why they were designed in an untransparent way. And so I don't think that these protests are going to change the government's mind about the omnibus law. But as I said, you know, my hope is that they will contribute to a wider sort of public appreciation of the dangers of kind of, you know, democratic decline within Indonesia's political system.
Right. And I think that segues nicely into the next question, because as you mentioned, the omnibus law protest isn't the only major protest in recent years. So last year, for example, protests took place across Indonesia against government's efforts to curb powers of the Anti-Corruption Commission, as well as a slew of other legislative proposals that they fear will curb freedom of expression, limit personal freedoms, and also harm the environment. There are also so many other proposals pending that seek to revise the country's criminal code, which includes making it a crime to insult the president's honor and a ban on extramarital sex, and also, you know, laws that would potentially reduce women's autonomies over their own bodies. So there's loads of things going here, and this has caused, you know, dissent, like you mentioned. But at the same time, this is President Joko Widodo or Jokowi's second term as the country's president, right? So do the masses like him? Are we seeing an increasingly polarized Indonesia?
Yeah, it's a great question. Is he a popular president? Mm-hmm. You know, do the masses like him? Well, the answer is yes. He remains a very popular second-term president, which is interesting in and of itself, because a lot of these changes, these you know, pieces of legislation that have been introduced over the past 2 years or year and a half rather, are deeply unpopular. But as a president, he remains, his popularity and people, the public satisfaction with Jokowi as a president remains very stable and remains at around between, it's kind of, you know, moved around between the low 60s to 68%. At the moment it's 68%.
Why is this so?
I debate this very often with Indonesian political experts, you know, within the country and outside of Indonesia. And there's a couple of theories, right? So Jokowi is personally a very popular political figure. He, you know, I'm sure many listeners know the kind of the backstory to his rise to power by now. You know, he rose to the presidency very quickly, but he started as, you know, a small town mayor, got a lot of stuff done. He was very popular with people. He had a reputation for being kind of very close to the people, communicating well with people of all different class backgrounds. And then he won the governorship of Jakarta. He never went for a second term. He was so popular that his party, PDIP, believed that he should run for presidency before he'd finished his term as governor of Jakarta. Right. And that's what he did, and he won the presidency and was re-elected in 2019. And so he's this political figure who's kind of the product of reformasi and the product of, you know decentralized local elections in Indonesia. And he also isn't from the kind of the old sort of familiar caste of politico-bureaucratic elites from the New Order. And he was seen as clean, most importantly, not corrupted, part of that old oligarchic class. So despite, I think, the shine coming off that image over the last few years in many, many ways, and this bill would be a pretty good example of that. You know, he went from being a president who was so, they call him rakyat, so for the people, for the little people, you know, to a president who's basically designed a law that so heavily favors the business class that people are calling it a kind of, you know, a law for the oligarchs. And yet he remains popular. And I think it's because it's almost a populist sort of characteristic that Jokowi has, that no matter what he does, no matter what kind of unpopular laws he introduces or controversies he may or may not, his government may be, you know, associated with, he as an individual continues to attract so much respect and so much adoration, especially from his like solid loyal base, that he can kind of do no wrong. He's just, they still see him as the only political figure right now, you know, in contemporary Indonesia that is sort of distinct from the old corrupt elite, even though that's not true in reality anymore these days. So I think that's one reason. And the other reason is that actually when you look at sort of the numbers, like let's talk before COVID, you know, Indonesia was, growth was sort of steady. He had brought, you know, poverty down. You kind of, he had a whole bunch of sort of impressive statistics to his name when it comes to the economy. And I think Indonesians really do still see him as someone who wants to get things done, works really hard, is committed to his goals. And even if those goals are extremely narrow, you know, I think a lot of Indonesians continue to admire him. Now, the other, and this links to the question about polarization. Mm-hmm. One of the other reasons we can see that Jokowi, we understand Jokowi's sustained popularity is because Indonesia is indeed becoming a much more polarized country than it was during the Yudhoyono years. And it's polarized along a kind of religious cleavage, where on the one hand you have, and this is a really old cleavage in Indonesian politics, it's just been very much sort of reinvigorated or sort of remobilized in recent years.
Right.
And on the one hand you have, you know, Indonesians who would like to see a larger role for Islam, Islamic precepts in sort of public and political life. On the other hand, you have Indonesians who we kind of refer to as having a more pluralist orientation. And that's how the political system is sort of structured. So there are parties that promote a pluralist, kind of multi-religious sort of ideology and foundation for the Indonesian state. And then you have the Islamic parties who would like to see more kind of a larger role for Islam. And Jokowi represents the pluralist camp. And Prabowo, his former opponent in two consecutive presidential elections, is not actually a very conservative Muslim at all, but he mobilized the conservative Islamic vote and Islamic base and Islamic organizations right. in order to try and defeat Jokowi and his pluralist coalition. And that these elections have over time really kind of politicized this old cleavage. And even though Prabowo is actually now a member of Jokowi's coalition, that those divisions, those ideological and religious divisions, are continuing to sort of simmer at the grassroots level. And what you see in patterns of in public opinion polls is that the people who voted for Jokowi in 2014 and 2019 continue to see everything that he does in a sort of positive light. It's very partisan. And that includes the COVID response, which has been widely criticized by all health experts and economists and all sorts of people from all sorts of different segments of Indonesian society.
Right.
But his base remains remarkably loyal. And those who voted against him are the ones who find fault with Jokowi, with the way that democracy is developing in Indonesia, with the government's economic policies, with the COVID response. So the population is actually... has become increasingly partisan and divided. And what that means is that often, you know, in deeply polarized societies, you know, they choose their leader, they choose their party, and they remain loyal to that party, whatever, you know, whatever the policy outcomes, whatever the policy sort of innovations that, or problems that arise, you know, it's purely based on partisan loyalties.
I guess, you know, it's like they say, you either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain. Okay, Eve, we only have a couple of minutes left. So before I let you go, given everything that is going on in Indonesia over the past couple of years, we talk about protests, we talk about polarization. Mm. Are we heading in a more progressive or oppressive Indonesia in the coming years? Or is the situation so fluid right now that things could just go left or right at any time?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It is quite hard to answer, but I guess, and this relates to that previous question about polarization. So until these student-led protests, we really hadn't seen in Indonesia for a really long time. We hadn't seen any kind of effective, significant or coherent kind of pro-democracy movement. We really hadn't seen that in Indonesia. You know, there are obviously liberal democratic civil society organizations who've continued to kind of defend Indonesia's democratic institutions against, you know, years and years of erosion by consecutive governments. But we haven't, we hadn't seen this kind of outpouring of, like, you know, progressive pro-democracy ideas and mobilization onto the streets of Indonesia for such a long time. And part of the reason, actually, especially during the Jokowi era, is that that ideological polarization I just described, whether it's in Indonesia or in America or Turkey or wherever, you know, what polarization does is it makes people's support for democracy, it renders their support for democracy contingent, because that sort of animus between two groups and the dislike and the fear that one side holds for the other means that they're both willing to kind of use illiberal tools or to sacrifice kind of democratic norms and principles in order to prevent their enemy from accessing power, resources, or winning elections.
Right.
We've kind of seen that over the years in Indonesia, and that made us all feel very, very kind of negative and very concerned about the direction of Indonesian democracy. Now, what we have seen, what these student protests last year in defense of the KPK and now in opposition to the omnibus law, you sort of get this sense that, okay, there is still in Indonesia this sort of, you know, support for a liberal democracy or for the principles of liberal democracy, and that support within a certain constituency seems to cut across those ideological, that ideological cleavage that I described. You know, when you look at the protesters, the students, they come from, you can kind of see they're coming from all different sort of socio-religious kind of backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
These your student executive bodies and campuses, they're not organized along ideological lines, you know. And some of them would be coming from kind of conservative, more Islamist sort of, you know, backgrounds, and others more liberal, pluralist kind of backgrounds. So this kind of gives us, you know, that's why the movement is so important and so interesting. But it's also a movement that the government has been extremely concerned with containing and repressing. So at this stage, it's not clear, there's no clear pathway for this movement to become, I get to, for it to have a kind of concrete policy effect. We
right.
haven't seen that happen yet. We haven't seen that kind of progressivism begin to sort of have real policy outcomes yet. But as I said earlier, that doesn't mean that it can't. In fact, what we're already seeing is the discourse within media circles, within civil society groups from across different sorts of spectrums, you know, begin to use words like democratic regression, begin to kind of ring alarm bells about the repressive strategies of the Jokowi administration. I think that still Indonesia is still very, very polarized, and that kind of it's really hard to create a pro-democracy movement in the context of deep socio-religious polarization. But the student movement, I think, has given at least some people within Indonesia hope.
Well, as a wise woman in a galaxy far, far away once said, rebellions are built on hope. Thank you so much for joining me today, Eve.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Have a good day.
That was Eve Warburton, postdoctoral fellow at the National University of Singapore's Asia Research Institute and co-editor of the book Democracy in Indonesia, From Stagnation to Regression. And we were having a conversation on student-led protests that have been going on in Indonesia because of the recently passed omnibus law. So if you missed any part of this conversation or any previous Live and Learn episodes, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or you can even subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. You just have to search BFM Live and Learn. Once again, I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.